Welcome, everybody. Thank you all for being here. I know we had an unfortunate schedule conflict today with the Souter Science Lecture, thanks to the snow day last week. March, there's always an embarrassment of riches of interesting events being planned. Everybody seems to like to plan things for March, so snow day really throws a monkey wrench into all of that. But we're very happy to have Holly Scott with us today. Holly has been teaching in our history department how many years now, off and on for about 5 years, and also has been doing really excellent work with our graduate students in the Writing Center. She's recently taken a bigger and more steady job than what we've been able to offer her at UVA in their School of Continuing Studies. So we will be, or have lost her services in the Writing Center and in the History Department. But I'm glad we have this opportunity to do a little bit of a farewell celebration as well as hear about your new book. Holly received her PhD in history from the American University in 2013. She has a master's in American Studies from Penn State, and she's a graduate of EMU with a bachelor's degree in English and Justice, Peace, and Conflict Studies in 2002. She has a number of publications, but the most significant is her recent book, Younger Than That Now, The Politics of Age in the 1960s, and we're going to be hearing about aging 60s folks today. So I'm as a member of that population, this may be the first academic talk I've heard about my passing. Holly's also a fairly regular contributor to the Anabaptist Historians blog, so take a look at that someday, too, and the interesting writing that goes up there. So, Holly, welcome. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here. Can you guys hear me okay if I'm sitting? Okay, thanks. All right, so let's start out today. I have a question for you guys. How many of you are familiar with the line, don't trust anyone over 30? Oh, excellent. And if I describe for you a fiery young radical with his long hair and he's bringing down the barricades and he's taking over the dean's office in 1968, and then I ask you to picture him in 1988. Do any of your minds picture him all nice and clean cut and in a suit and working on Wall Street? Not in this crowd. Okay, good, because he probably wouldn't be, but that is sometimes where people's mind goes when you say youth radicals in the 60s. When I was working on this, it started as my dissertation, and I would get these two lines from people when I would tell them what I was working on. They'd say, don't trust anyone over 30. Or they'd say, are you going to explain how they all sold out and became yuppies in the 1980s? And I'd be like, well, I can't explain something that did not happen, so no. alas. So these two things have a lot of cultural staying power. It's nice to see EMU is a little immune from at least one of them. I think probably most people, even if they're not that familiar with the 60s, know that there was a lot of protest and know that young people are somehow pretty important in that protest. So when I was looking around for topics to write on that would be related to this period, one of the things that sort of stood out to me was just how, you know, there's been a lot of attention to youth, and they're not the only ones who are important in the 60s, not by a long shot. There's a lot of folks who are older who are participating, of course. So I really wanted to kind of look at what was it about young people and about them becoming involved in politics, specifically radical politics, that really seemed to capture people's imaginations. And what did that mean for these activists themselves? How did they kind of use that identity as youth as part of how they saw themselves as organizers? And I have two main points I'm going to look at today. One is that the New Left, and when I say New Left, I mean kind of the collection of anti-war, student rights, counterculture kind of fusion. So looking at how is it that for New Left activists, youthfulness kind of becomes a badge of pride, but also how does it become something fraught with a lot of anxiety? And then the second thing I want to look at is sort of why is it a badge of pride? And one of the things I argue in the book is that in some ways this is kind of built on our already existing sort of cultural symbolism about youth. But that there's also something very important and internal to radical movements in the 1960s that drives a youth emphasis. I'm not going to name what that is yet, so that you're all kind of on the edges of your seat and waiting for me to say, what is that thing? I will get to it. So a major source for me when I was working on this is what's called the Underground Press Collection. These are do-it-yourself newspapers that young radicals would put out. There's hundreds of these papers all over the country by the late 60s. And somebody very graciously microfilmed them all so I could look at them in Alderman Library at UVA and need a new glasses prescription by the end of that. And I don't have a picture to show you about what I'm about to describe, and my apologies for that, but microfilm, if you've ever used it, it's fuzzy, and all my scans from it just really don't project very well. But I want to describe for you a comic that ran in a 1969 underground press. And I think this comic kind of stands in for both the badge of pride in youth and also the anxiety about age. So this comic actually ran in two papers. It ran in an Austin, Texas paper called The Rag and in a New York City paper called Rat, and this is in 1969. And it has a panel of a father and son facing off, and they're arguing with each other about the value of protest. And the father is this short, kind of fat, dumpy guy. He's kind of bald on top. And the son is a tall, lanky guy with a nice long ponytail, and he's got little granny glasses and a beret, so we know that like he's a good, you know, radical youth guy. And they trade these one-liners back and forth. So dad says, "Order is a hallmark of civilization." And son says, "Order supports the status quo." And dad says, "Patriotism, your country, right or wrong." And son says, "Patriotism, it's the last refuge of a scoundrel." And the dad's getting really mad. He's like making a fist, and then he's making two fists, and then he's like covering his eyes, like just, "Oh, I hate this kid, he's so aggravating." And in the last panel, dad uncovers his eyes, and he gets this big grin on his face, like, "I got it, I got him." He says, "Son, rebellion is just a youthful phase." And then son takes off his beret, and we see that he too is bald on top, despite the ponytail, and he says, "Dad, I'll be 41 in May." So, we have a lot going on here. We have got kind of a celebration of being a young radical, right? It's father-son, it's very much playing with like generational tension. Dad is upset, he's almost like comically upset, he kind of looks ridiculous. Son looks all calm, right? But then there's this sort of kicker of like, I'm not just a young radical, right? I'm not gonna outgrow this. Which is definitely a fear that people have in the 60s. They hear that. There is a steep cost to being mesmerized by your own youth culture. It can limit your appeal to other people, it can limit building your base, but it made a lot of anxiety for participants who are all very aware of the looming deadline of age 30. And there's a lot of discussion out there in the media about, don't worry about these kids, they're gonna settle down eventually. So, Why would a movement pick such a fraught symbol? Part of this answer, New Left activists are Americans. Like a lot of other Americans, they have already in place certain symbolism and associations built with youth. In our culture, youth can often sort of stand for innovation, energy, idealism in a good way. Sometimes we sort of associate them with nature and growth and potential, almost life itself, right? And that could be a very good symbol for you to use, especially if you're a peace movement and you want to draw in the sense of young people kind of being misused or sort of wasted by society. And you see a lot of this in the underground press, even if it's not sort of specifically talking about youth, but sort of this idea of who are we, right? And how are we kind of being misused and what we would have to bring to society. Youth also has a shadow side in our culture. They're immature, they're temperamental, they're fickle, they're easily manipulated or led astray. They might be idealistic, but maybe that also means that they are naive. We do not consider adolescent to be a compliment in our society, right? If I tell you you're acting like an adolescent, I'm not complimenting you. But the shadow side to youth was also very useful. If you want to revel in not being understood or in maybe seeming a little bit more threatening than you are, that could be very useful. Kind of the masters in the New Left of using kind of the threatening youth image would be the Yippies. YIPPY stands for Youth International Party. It's not actually a party. It's kind of a joke. It's more of like a media spectacle, haha, like let's pretend we're a party because society expects there to be like organizations and we don't really need to be an organization. The figureheads for this group are Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. And both Hoffman and Rubin are writing a lot of books about youth revolution. They're kind of getting a lot of media attention. And they really draw on this kind of shadow side of youth. Rubin says, quote, "We didn't grow up, we're permanent adolescents." Hoffman writes in 1968, "Runaways are the backbone of the youth revolution." And I think it's helpful to know that when Abby Hoffman wrote this, he was the 32-year-old divorced father of two small children, which is just an interesting side note. That's not unusual for the Yippies. A lot of the folks who are the most involved in that are actually in their 30s and are older even than Abby Hoffman, their mid to late 30s. If there is anybody in the New Left pushing 41 and bald on top with a ponytail, it's a Yippie. So the New Left tries to play with both sides of symbolism about youthfulness. So they like to show themselves as idealistic, kind of this life force of society. You know, don't waste us, don't send us off to Vietnam to just be slaughtered. But they also like to call on the idea of like, hey, we could be dangerous. We could steal the youth right out of your kindergartens, right? We have appeal. But even more importantly for a lot of these activists is that being young to them symbolizes oppression. And that's the really big deal for why they want to use this symbol and why there's so much emphasis on being a youth movement. And that's growing out of some very specific things about radical culture in the 1960s and less growing out of kind of mainstream American culture. And I came to this kind of thinking about the difference between some young activists. So a lot of my book is looking at mostly white and fairly affluent activists, and with that often male, because male voices do tend to dominate in a lot of the underground press. But I also looked at some underground women's newspapers, so feminist newspapers, as well as papers that are coming out of the Black student movement, the Chicano movement, American Indian movement as well. And I found that those activists do not share the same attention to youth or youthfulness, and they're not trying to play with that symbol. And there's a couple of different reasons for this. For women, they have kind of their own thing going on with age. Feminists are starting to talk about, you know, how does society kind of write off older women, devalue older women? and very much sort of trying to rebel against the idea of sort of young women used as, you know, yeah, they're kind of celebrated in a cult of youth, but they're turned into these sex objects, so that feels kind of uncomfortable. The New Left's own obsession with age could also be very sexist. So I have a quote here from Penn State University underground paper called The Water Tunnel, and this too is from 1969. And the author, who's a young man, is describing everything that's wrong with America versus all the things that are great about the student movement. And he says, America is, quote, a sagging old bitch fearing the young because they expose the wrinkles under her cosmetic mask. A greedy old witch grabbing up the world's riches for fear they won't be shared. A sad old woman who can't have children because she won't let them be young. This piece was a little incoherent. So if you're like, wait, what now? you didn't mishear me. But it has this kind of really sexist connotation of the old woman who's just this like prudish, nasty figure. You could see why maybe some young feminists would feel a little uncomfortable with that, not be really into following that. The other thing, of course, is that for young women and for young activists of color, they are looking to build common connections with elders, right? Other women, regardless of their life stage, other African Americans, other Mexican Americans, you know, what do we have in common together? What is our shared history of oppression? And what I really want to focus on here is that sometimes when people look at the 60s, it's this easy answer of like, oh, why was a youth a big deal? Well, you know, there's so many young people, and they're all part of this generation that's had a lot of attention to them as baby boomers. They've got this generational conflict, generation gap. Of course, they're just gonna make a big deal out of being young. But not all young people do that. So there's nothing inherent about being young in the 60s that would make you emphasize your youthfulness. Young women don't do it. Young people of color don't do it. This is where the white New Left is trying to tap into something that they've learned over in the civil rights movement. This is a very important slogan to come out of civil rights, and it says that a real radical organizes around their own oppression. This is a big concept for people. So the New Left in many ways kind of grows out of civil rights. A lot of these people have direct experience over there. And there's been growing critique of the white northern liberal who swoops into Mississippi and is like, hey, I'm gonna fix everything. And people saying, that's what a liberal does. A liberal goes out and tries to help other people out and try to like do good works for them. That's not a radical. You know, a radical like gets to the root of things by finding where they are oppressed and learning to find that agency and power in kind of acting against that. So organize around your own oppression. That is a quote I see all over the place in the underground press. Far more than don't trust anyone over 30, which actually isn't quoted all that much. So I think that's what's driving a lot of this emphasis. If you are a young, fairly affluent white man, you're looking around, you're like, where does this fit into my life? Ah, with my age. You guys are probably familiar with why a person might feel oppressed because of age. One of the biggies is the draft, right? I'm 18 years old, I can be sent off to fight in Vietnam, but I'm not old enough to vote. Seems like an obvious form of sort of being oppressed. University policies. I've got a student government that doesn't get to do anything other than plan parties. I've got a dorm curfew that I don't like. They're pretty, depending on the campus, fairly what we might consider strident restrictions on politics or free speech on campus. A lot of complaints about no student voice in the curriculum or how you run a university. And the hope for most of the most committed organizers in the New Left is that you're not just gonna stop with student rights, that you're gonna keep making a chain of connections. And the reasoning that I see a lot in the underground press kind of goes like this. I'm gonna find this person who hates the dorm curfew. I'm gonna get them to protest the curfew. Then they're gonna ask, well, wait, why do I even have a curfew? And the answer I'm going to give them is because they want to police your behavior and make sure you're not out at night doing something you're not supposed to be doing that might break our sort of middle-class standards of propriety. Why can't I break middle-class standards of propriety? Because I'm being trained to be a good worker and a good cog in the war machine. And so we're going to get from dorm curfew to war in Vietnam. So you're not supposed to just stop it. Like, young people are oppressed. You're supposed to continue it. Or why should you have student rights? Student rights feel good, but also, like, well, if you had some rights, maybe you would say, hey, university, stop that defense contract. We don't like that. Start a women's studies department. Hire some African-American professors. You know, we would use this to kind of tap into these other movements, and that's one of the kind of hoped-for chains of reasoning that's going to happen with this. Interesting thing I found, though, and this also really highlighted for me what young activists are trying to go for. The idea of organizing around your oppression is so paramount that a lot of these activists create parallels between radical youth culture and race that are really remarkably tone deaf. I'll read you a quote from a 1967 Underground Press article. This is recounting two young men who've been hitchhiking across the South, and they are, they've got long hair, they've got beards, you know, they look like hippies, and they get they're just harassed all over the place, right? And in one town, they get wrongly accused of stealing, they get thrown into jail for the night, they get roughed up a little, told, you know, don't come back to this town, right? Move on. And the author notes, quote, "It's hard to be different. If you want a true life lesson in democracy, grow a beard, or let your hair grow, or stain your skin." There's a lot of these examples floating around the underground press. This idea of being a radical person is going to mark you as an outsider, much like race, and they use a lot of racial parallels. To put it in some context, yes, depending where you are in the country, long hair could indeed get you beaten up or make you a target, sure. That doesn't make it just like race, which is not just my critique. There's also a steady chorus in the underground press that's like, hold on, not the same. Yeah, you got beaten up, you didn't get killed. So yeah, there's some pushback to that, but it doesn't stop people from continuing to make those parallels. So it's a very common thing to see. So we've got youth as a symbol in kind of these two very important ways, right? One is that you can kind of tap into broader American symbolism about both a sort of a good side of youth and the bad side of youth. The other thing is that this really lets you kind of connect to this broader movement culture that's been built in the 60s. And in the New Left, the biggest insult you can give somebody is to say, you're being a liberal, not a radical, right? So everybody's very anxious to like tap into what a real radical would be like. But youth isn't just a powerful symbol, it is a source of major anxiety for the New Left. And this was something that I was really not expecting to find, and I think it's interesting. There's a lot more angst about turning 30 than I thought I was gonna see. And there's, along with that, kind of a desire to reach out and build a broader base than just being a student movement. This doesn't mean that people actually successfully manage to really reach beyond their own boundaries. It's often a little bit clumsily done, but there's certainly like a sincere desire to like be about more than just young people. So I want to come back here to that don't trust anyone over 30 quote. It has an interesting history. So this quote first shows up in the fall of 1964. It comes out of the free speech movement, which is taking place at the University of California at Berkeley. Kind of the short version of this is that students and administrators are arguing about how much, if any, speech and political activity should be allowed on campus. And it's a really well-known protest movement. There are hundreds of students involved. There's several very high-profile building takeovers that happen. It's very much in the national news. And along with that is the question of who's pulling the strings of these students. So it's 1964, and when there's protest, everybody's like, where are the communists? The communists have got to be involved in this somehow. They're using these poor, innocent students to further their agenda. So the activists are getting a lot of leading questions that are like, oh, so who's really in charge of your movement? Like, who funds you? Who gave you the idea to take over that building? And they're just getting really tired of it because they totally understand that the subtext of this is like, you know, are you a puppet for some other group? And that's where this saying comes from. A fellow named Jack Weinberg, who is interviewed by a San Francisco Chronicle reporter, who's like poking him about this, and he finally says to her, hey, we have a saying in the movement, we don't trust anyone over 30. It's not a saying, he just makes it up on the spot. And it gets, you know, it gets quoted a lot more in the press than it does actually in these movements. But what he means by it is, there's no one older than 30, meaning there's no old left people here. There's no, you know, socialist communist people who are pulling our strings. Other than maybe mom and dad, because a lot of these folks come from kind of radical homes. But that's not to say that, you know, the fact that it doesn't get repeated in kind of a major way doesn't mean it doesn't resonate with people, because it is so much in the mainstream press. And if you're a 15 or 16-year-old kid, you know, watching this on TV, you know, in Iowa or something, and you hear this, you kind of think like, yeah, sounds about right. So it has influence, but I think it freaks out people in the movement more than anything. And the piece to Jack Weinberg, the guy who made this up, that I find interesting is that he is not an undergraduate student when he says this. He is a mid-20s graduate school dropout who is working full-time for a civil rights organization. And about 20 years later, when he's reflecting on the free speech movement and asked about this quote that he came up with, I found an interview with him where he says, part of what I was thinking about was, quote, what am I going to do when I outlive this campus life? Where is there in the world for somebody like me? I've devoted a lot of time to these movements. What's going to happen? So there's a lot of anxiety about that exact question, and it's there kind of from the start. So you might be familiar with Students for a Democratic Society, which is called SDS, which is a group that gets kicked off in 1960. And so by the mid-60s, a lot of their first generation of leaders are in their mid-20s, and they're asking that same question, what next? What happens to me? I'm not in school anymore. One idea that starts to be floated around 65, 66 is we should create something called MDS. Nobody told them the acronym was taken. Stands for Movement for a Democratic Society. So we would have these chapters that are for adults, like SDS graduates, as well as like other folks who could be brought in to this. They don't manage to do that in the 60s, but they do in the early 2000s. A lot of the SDS grads like create an MDS movement that at least had a presence on the internet, if not anywhere else. So, interesting. In the fall of 66, a University of Pennsylvania SDSer writes this, if the new left remains exclusively a student left, it will die. And he warned about, quote, four-year radicals, people who aren't going to do anything else. Also in 66, there's an SDSer who describes himself as a, quote, full-time worker, family man, and evening student, and he says, people with kids to feed cannot go to jail with impunity or throw away jobs. But, he says, this doesn't make you less radical. He says, adults might actually be more likely to be radical because they confront, quote, the effect of having less and less control in your daily life and struggling to survive. So it's this idea, adults might have an untapped potential about them. And not just in SDS, but in the wider student movement, there starts to be some attention to how are you going to actually become these 41-year-old radicals? And there are some ideas out there about ways that you could really start to transform parts of adult life. How could you radicalize your professions? And that means more than just, hey, I'm an attorney, I'll take on some cases for free, and I'll, you know, do some good works. But like, how could you sort of center your professional life? One example I found was, how could you get a whole bunch of radical teachers to all work in one school district together, and then they could really like change policy about education, right? So these are kind of, what are our collective efforts we could do? What are the kind of communal living situations that we could set up that are sustainable? You know, these kinds of things. And a lot of folks kind of watching youth in the 60s are saying, oh, look at this. This is interesting. We've got kind of a lengthening of adolescence happening because these folks don't want to grow up and look like adults. But I see something a little different in the 60s. I think a lot of these folks are actually thinking, how do I change what adulthood looks like? This is a quote from 1968. This is a newsletter called Radicals in the Professions, and it's talking about kind of practical steps you can take. It says, quote, "We believe that we can find ways of being politically effective while leading stable lives, having families, living in one place for 5 years, doing work we like. We have to. If radicals all become frazzled, neurotic adults by the time they are 30, we are going to have a frazzled, neurotic movement." And this is the number one place that I saw engagement with the line, "Don't trust anyone over 30. It's people writing about how they're sort of disturbed by it and how they want to make sure that doesn't come true. I'm not going to turn 30 and turn into somebody else. And there's kind of a debate going on in the 60s about how should you classify or understand these radical young people. Is this a prolonging of adolescence that we're seeing? Or, and there's some sociologists who are a lot more sympathetic to the movements, and they're saying, actually, you know, this is not adolescence. They're saying these kids, you know, they're done with kind of a storm and stress period, identity formation, you know, breaking away from mom and dad. Like, that's not what this is. This isn't prolonged adolescence. This is some kind of different life stage that's taking shape. It's maybe a different way of being an adult, or maybe it's some kind of stage in between youth and adulthood that we haven't seen before. And there's others who say, actually, some of these most committed folks, they're committed to the movement in the way that in the past you might have made a commitment to a spouse or to a career. So it's not that they're not like taking that next step of adulthood where you kind of make your commitments to things. And much like, you know, society isn't quite sure where to place these folks, sometimes activists themselves don't quite know where to place themselves. A writer who I enjoyed reading for exactly this tension, a man named Michael Rossman, and he starts being active in Berkeley in the late 50s when he begins college, and he stays kind of involved in these movements, his entire life, essentially. But he's a writer, and he does a lot of traveling and kind of writing pieces about what he's found around the country. And his writings show this tension between, on one hand, he like really embraces the idea of being a kid. He uses the word kid all the time, and he uses it interchangeably with our people, brother, sister. There's this sense of sort of kid is our badge of pride. It's our collective identity. And he talks a lot about all the things that are wrong with adults, but he always puts these little quote marks around adults. And I saw this a lot with other writers, too. They would say adults. And at one point, in 68, he's talking about the problem of reaching adults, and he puts in parentheses, in italics, "no better term." And I thought that was interesting. Like, he seems to have a sense of, like, yeah, there's actually something a little different here than just youth versus age. But he's not quite breaking out of framing it that way. And he ponders, he says, quote, "Is there a deep connection between our notion of a rigid adulthood, tolerating no serious change or discontinuity, and our rigid America, now beginning to crack with pain?" And this is written by somebody who is 28, 29 years old, so right, he's almost at the limit, starting to wrestle with these things. So there's anxiety going on. And along with that anxiety is the desire to kind of reach out beyond the youth demographic. And I love this next one. If any of you have anybody here been to an old time music festival in the region? All right, so this is for you guys. This is a young woman in Texas, and she had gone to Woodstock in 1969. And now it's 2 years later, and she just got home from an Appalachian string band festival, an old time music festival. And she's comparing the two, and she finds Woodstock to be lacking. So she's really inspired. She's gone to this place and met all these like elderly fiddlers, and they've been like jamming with the young radicals, and if you've ever been to one of these festivals, you might know that yes, indeed, most of the participants look like they discovered this right around 1970. Yes, they kind of lodged themselves here. But she says, you know, the problem with Woodstock was its emphasis on, quote, youth, and she puts it in all capital letters with two exclamation points. Youth cut off from history and the rest of the people in a real basic way, orphaned from the strength that comes with roots and experience, held together mostly by symbols, long hair, and marijuana. Real revolution, she says, is not going to come from youth culture, but programs that bring people together, like this festival. She says, the kind of programs that can, quote, cross lines of privilege, lines of age, and that can make a real difference. Now, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to walk away from what I call in the book the movement's youth frame, or the assumption that youth are kind of the most important folks and the naturally radical folks. This is a quote from the Willamette Bridge, which is an Oregon paper in 1970. And this writer is talking, he's writing just after the deaths at Kent State University, and talking about a protest they had about this in Oregon, and he's sort of sad that like nobody showed up other than the students. And then he thinks about it and he's like, well, I guess we haven't really paid attention to people off the campus, so I kind of get it. And he calls on the other folks, he says, it's time to, quote, get away from the whole image slash media trip and the unity in youth culture trip that have been laid on us both by the pigs and by ourselves. And the pigs in this case means the media, just to be clear, because pigs can mean different things in the 60s. Oh. So, what had the pigs been doing? For the most part, the mainstream press has been like really fascinated with the idea of youth revolt and kind of overemphasizing that story a little bit, sensationalizing it. And they're often drawing in kind of this idea of sort of spoiled young people out of control. And they say, oh, they're protesting, it's a fad, that's what adolescents do, don't worry about it. There's also a lot of sort of, oh, they're used to getting their way, they've been raised permissively on Dr. Spock, and you know, like, what do you expect? They're angry, they're gonna take over the dean's office because they're having a temper tantrum, essentially. Don't worry about it, they're gonna turn 30, it'll be fine. There's a major exception to this, and that is if you are a young activist of color, you are not talked about in this way. There are all these profiles of kind of like white student activists and like, where are they from and who are mom and dad and how were they raised and how, like what could be going on here? Nope, not a thing if you are an African-American student who's taken over the dean's office. That's not where the media's go-to place is. Instead, there's a lot of like kind of imagery of sort of the scary, threatening black power militant, often kind of taken, like, in some ways, kind of, it's assumed that, like, this is a legitimate cause that you're protesting, but that, like, you're also sort of this, like, overly threatening force. So you're not sort of this adolescent mob of people doing pranks and hijinks. But it's also not a terribly good stereotype, either. You know, it's not like you're getting heard in the press. And that takes me to the early 60s. So I wanted to close with just a couple of things about the early 60s. I think in many ways it might be the more analogous time period to now. Student movement kind of starts out at that term, student movement, as it appears in the early 60s, really means students in the civil rights movement. Students come in, especially with the lunch counter sit-ins in 1960, and they're definitely like pushing the idea of like using civil disobedience, which was already a part of the civil rights movement, but they're saying, we gotta revive this, we gotta do more of this. And they're seen as kind of this, you know, new force that's generating a lot of energy for the movement. And they too are having a little bit of a generation gap. You know, they're trained by and mentored by older people in the movement, but they're also in many ways critical of elders in the movement and saying, you know, you've gone too slow. It's time to let us kind of get into this and lead. But I did not find a lot of emphasis in things from the early 60s that kind of overly emphasize youth or try to sort of draw on youth as a symbol. And that's true for both civil rights activists as well as white students in the New Left in the early 60s. They emphasize much more the idea of sort of the rights of citizenship. Rights and responsibilities for citizenship start at any age. You know, it's shouldn't just be in high school and in college and like prepare for a career, but you need to take part in something now. Very strong sense of sort of elders dropped the ball, the adults have not gotten this done, so we need to come in. And there's surprisingly little attention to student activism in the early 60s. Especially of groups like SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I kind of expected to see them all over the press, and there's definitely a wave of coverage of the lunch counter sit-ins, but then not quite as much coverage of young people. When there is coverage, though, it does not go to that sort of like, oh, silly spoiled youth, you know, don't worry about it. Instead, there's all this praise. And the praise is partly reaction to what 50s youth were imagined to be. There's a lot of panic in the 1950s about, oh, these young people, they're so conformist, they only care about sort of parties and fun and what's gonna happen to our society, they're so frivolous. They're the silent generation, right? So there's a lot of discussion early 60s about like, yay, the silent generation is gone, they found their voice, woohoo. Although it's like praising student activists, it's also sort of setting them up as sort of a foil to this imagined typical youth who's like a frivolous adolescent, right? So still have kind of some negative ideas about youth. And the coverage you get changes pretty fast if the media does not like or understand your cause or what you're about. So definitely saw that happening. Which I think gives us some things to talk about with today, but I will leave it there and see what you guys want to hear more about. Yes?
From the 60s, early 62 maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Did you run into that much in your research? Did it play an important part, do you think?
So Port Huron Statement, which is the founding sort of who we are and what we're about document that comes out of Students for a Democratic Society. Surprisingly, very little to say about youth. There is a section in there on students, but it's very specific to sort of like how could students kind of awaken the rest of the university. It's very like role specific and less kind of life stage specific. And a lot more sort of like that idea of learning to act, learning to have a voice, be a citizen, right? So they're very emphasis kind of on that and less on kind of later 60s sort of like, youth are the leaders. It's more like, how can we kind of tap into other sectors of society? I kind of expected to find a little bit of this youth celebration there, and it wasn't quite what I'd expected there. Yeah.
Hey, what do, I'm guessing you've been following what's happened after the Florida high school shooting, and it struck me that, right, there's a lot of parallels to what you're talking about, although it's even pushed it back younger, right? Now we're looking at 13, 14, 15-year-olds sort of being held up in the spotlight. And we certainly get the same critiques in that this is the voice of the next generation, and we need to listen to them. Isn't that great? And then also, like, what do you know? You're 12, right? What parallels and what differences are you seeing?
Today's students remind me so much of the early 60s stuff that I saw. It's been interesting to see, like, other than one Parkland student who I heard give a very, like, kind of profanity-laced, like, diatribe against adults, I haven't heard kind of the, like, youth are surging together and, you know, screw you older people. Like, it's more like everybody act, everybody. And also, interestingly, especially with the Parkland folks, really, like, not allowing this media spotlight to divide from things like Black Lives Matter, to say like, we want to talk about all gun violence, like don't just focus on us as kind of these different folks. The idea of sort of like everybody should participate, just because I'm young doesn't mean that I kind of abdicate rights and responsibilities. And it's interesting to see how much of, you know, I think the idea of press coverage kind of relying on ideas about youth if you don't like someone's cause, because when I'm sitting in my car listening to NPR, I just hear all these reports that are like, oh, you know, kind of make it very much about the issue. And then every now and then I dipped over into other forms of media where there is more like, what do they know, youth, you know, it seems like a go-to place, which, yeah, it was very much the case with the 60s. If you're kind of outside the framework of what's what does a good student activist look like, or a cause that people are like, what do you mean? Like, we can't do this war, like, that's silly. Like, that's when you run into kind of those ideas being mobilized against you. Yeah, it's also just so different. I mean, you'd think there'd be a parallel with like war, right? Like, don't waste our lives in the war, but it actually felt less, people didn't lean on that as much in the 60s as one would, in not quite the same way. There's sort of an understanding of like, well, all generations have a war, right? Like, we've come after World War I, World War II, so it's not quite as vivid an example as like guns in schools, where it's like not all generations have like kind of done this and had to do their part, and so it seems to be a more pronounced part of things that's happening. But yeah, really kind of fascinating to see where it all goes. Yeah.
It feels to me like one of the things that happens, and this was in the 60s, and this is now, and this was, is that when adults take something up, it's a legitimate cause, but when we take something up, then we're just young and stupid and we don't know anything and we need to settle down and behave again.
Yeah, and you might get taken to task more for your behavior, right? Of like, if you do anything too rowdy, it's quickly written off. Which I heard a really good rebuke to that by one of these students at the march who said, like, I might be young, but what I've experienced in a closet in my school is more than most of you, so shut up. Just like, man. Solid point.
So, Holly, I wonder what you think of generational cycle theories. You know, some talk about three generational cycles, some four generational cycles. Mm-hmm. The simplest model is a very establishment generation, like World War II, mm-hmm. followed by a lost generation, like the silent generation, followed by a rebellious generation. Which would actually predict that the, not so much the millennials, but Generation Zs, the, mm-hmm. these young people of Parkland, would be the more rebellious. It tracks kind of nicely on the oldest child, middle child, younger child. Do you think there's anything to that, or complete hooey?
I will admit a bias here. I do not like generational cycle theory. I think our culture is way too seduced by generation ideas and generation gaps. I would say we're almost a little obsessed with that. And one generational theory that I do like a lot is actually the idea of, now I'm blanking out, the polar forms within a generation. And so something I haven't actually talked about here is there's a lot of right-wing youth in the 60s that are building the new right. And the way I've seen generational theory used to explain this is that a generation experiences a common set of events at a common age, but then they take that inspiration in these different directions. So I've grown up doing duck and cover under my desk, and I'm reacting to the Cold War. I could take that into the peace movement and be totally into ban the bomb, or I could be like, oh yeah, we need a strong defense. Like, and so you get these two very different forms within a generation. And if we kind of put too much emphasis on a generation being too much the same, I think we miss some things like that, as well as create just some very unproductive stereotypes about each other. And I have to say, I hear that a lot from people my age who want to, like, admittedly, like, it is fun to beat up on millennials and to beat up on baby boomers, especially if you're sandwiched in the middle and you feel like they both get all the attention. And like, but it's not actually productive, and it sometimes kind of helps, makes us lose sight of, like, what's the real culprit here? Like, I don't have a good job. It's not the boomer's fault. It's not the millennial's fault. It's somebody else's fault. So, yes. I answered all the questions.
I have a prediction on where this parking group is going to end up.
Yeah, I don't know.
Do you have a prediction about where the Parkland group, where it's going?
I'm not sure. The other thing that's interesting parallel there, much like students in the civil rights movement were kind of joining a movement already in place. These are people already joining a movement already in place. But it's a movement that really hasn't been going anywhere. So I don't know. Yeah, and I was trying to think about that. Like, historians don't like the future. We don't have any archival documents to like fall back on. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know. And I was thinking too, at first I was like, I feel like I should have some kind of advice for these students. And I was like, nope, don't think they need my advice. They look like they're doing just fine.
Holly, I guess one of my questions related to both Parkland, but thinking in the past of where our oppressions were actually different. Is there any possibility that in this moment, gun violence, that there, could you imagine any coalescing in a way very different than in the past that could emerge? That's something that I've been thinking about. Is there any way to sort of unite, bring, it still feels like there's these divisions of, so there's Black Lives Movement, and now there's the Parkland people. It's like, can we get beyond that?
I've been impressed by the attempt, at least, from some of the Parkland students to like to not get divided, and yet it's an uphill battle there. You know, one of the things I found in media coverage in the 60s is that you kind of get put in these little boxes like, oh, youth demonstrator, white. You know, oh, you know, radical, you know, Black power person, like, Black. Like, you can't, you don't, then you kind of lose sight of, like, the youth part of that identity or the student part of that identity. And it just seems like everything gets put so segmented and that the interconnectivity of movements got very easily lost, as well as sort of the complexity of real people's identities. We just seem to have a media culture that wants to really simplify things, and that's hard. It's a really big challenge. Also, there's knowing the broader thing, and then there's like acting on it, like in the 60s, where people know that there's maybe something a little problematic about making these racial analogies, and then like you still do it, and you can know that like yes, we should be very intersectional and combine school shooters with police violence and like violence within other communities, but there's knowing it and like saying it and kind of having the line, and then like that's different from like actually creating like a connected movement. So. It's a tangled way of saying I'm not sure.
I had the fun and ironic experience of taking several 15-year-olds to go see The Who last year. And so the discussion on the way home after 15-year-olds watch a bunch of 70-year-olds sing, oh, I hope I die before I get old.
Yeah, that's really weird.
The conversation, though, very much was that they very much enjoyed the concert and they liked this sort of rebellious spirit. Mm-hmm. This was before, right, sort of this youth movement had emerged around gun violence. But they were sort of like, why? They started to feel a sense of guilt in that, how can we be young and not have, like, why aren't, isn't it, aren't we supposed to be protesting stuff now? Like, right? Like, shouldn't I be radical in some way?
Oh, I hear you.
Before I get old, right? And so, is that? Do you also see that layered on that young people in the 60s feel the need to be radical simply because they are young?
Yeah. So, confession. This is a safe crowd. I'll make this confession. The start of this topic. I'm not a procrastinator. I like to get all things out of the way, like way ahead of time. So I was not 30 yet, and I was about 27, 28, and I was like having sort of a crisis about turning 30, which seems ridiculous now, I look at it. And I was digging into like, well, who cares about turning 30? And I was like, oh, but if a really big movement comes along, I won't be able to like take part or matter. And then I was like, that is the dumbest thing that I've ever thought. Like, and I hear you. Like, for those of us who came after and you have already, like that's something that's very different about student activism ever since the 60s, is that you have that thing in the past that you're gonna be compared to and that you kind of have to wrestle with. And I found a really interesting piece of advice, and so this came from Bernadine Dorn, who becomes infamous for being in the Weather Underground in the late 60s, so, you know, not somebody I really love to quote all that much, but in this case, I thought she was very helpful, and she's writing in a book in the early 2000s, and it's a letter to young activists, and one of the things she says is, like, the 60s are always gonna get used against you as a bludgeon, to be like, you're not as good as we were, or, you know, you should be doing it this way or that way. And she says, look, it wasn't really, she says, the 60s was never even really the 60s. Like, it always felt more unsure and halting. And if you were on this campus, you felt like you weren't really doing anything as good as they were over here. And like, why can't we be more like France? And like, you know, places that are having like these really big moments. And so everybody, she was kind of like, don't worry so much about it. Like, just do your thing and like do your best and like don't feel like you're not as good. The other thing that you're making me think of with the music, I found a lot more unnuanced thought about age in the music. And that's part of the book, is analyzing the messages that are out there in music. And I have to say that this project is really focusing on some of the most dedicated folks in the movement and not on just your average 19-year-old who goes to a demonstration once in a while and is probably maybe even a little bit more attached to the youth revolution thing and not thinking quite as complexly about that. And that was a segment of society. Those folks don't tend to contribute to the underground press, so I didn't really try to gauge sort of like what is your average youth culture participant really thinking. It was a little bit beyond my scope.
You mentioned the importance of the underground press in the 60s. And I was just curious, sort of with what we have seen now as far as scrutiny about mainstream media and the trustworthiness of media and things like this Cambridge Analytica scandal with Facebook and WikiLeaks and all of these things. I'm curious sort of this movement's relationship to media and a voice outside of the mainstream, and how you see that in relation to sort of the underground press.
Yeah. One thing I always tell students, because they think it sounds fun to read underground press papers, and one time I was like, you guys want to read some underground press stuff for a source? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, okay, but be prepared, because there's going to be like a 6-page long analysis of imperialism in this newspaper. Like, they sound really like they're fun newspapers, and they are. They have like comics and, you know, the going price of drugs and other things that are like exciting, but they also have these like incredibly long, detailed kind of like historical analysis of like how Indochina like conflict started, and I always read it and think, how did undergraduates voluntarily write this stuff for their papers? Like, it's, or maybe they did stuff for class. I don't know. Which seems a little different maybe from like sort of tweeting and blogging and things that are just a little more short form. You know, not that they don't, you know, have an important role to fill. But yeah, these underground papers are kind of an odd collection of different things, and some of them quite long-winded. So, yeah, but it seems like the internet could kind of function in that regard, that you can, you know, it's like a tool. The underground press is also a communication tool, so there's something called the Liberation News Service, which is like the radical version of the Associated Press that like compiles things and sends it out, so you might get things running in different papers. Which you don't need to do today. If you have the internet, you can just put up a site and have a place to connect in that way. But probably similar kinds of functions.
I know. This is my second question. Would you feel that people are listening, not just paying attention, but listening more to the Parkland group and those students than they were to the anti-war movement? And are they actually taking it more seriously?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Yeah? Yeah, it might depend, like, which segment of society we're talking about, maybe. Because some folks do listen in the 60s, and there does start to be, I would say, as acceptance and sort of critique of the Vietnam War grows, as that starts to be a bigger and bigger part of mainstream views in the 60s, that I did see press coverage shifting a little bit with that, so... Yeah, but I don't know quite how it would compare. I'm not sure. Good dissertation topic in 20 years.
Thanks a lot. That was a good colloquium session to end the year on. We ended with one that actually ran overtime because people had so much to talk about. So congratulations.